We're here today with Tom Gabbard of the Blumenthal Center here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I was realizing this morning when I woke up, we're coming pretty close to 20 years to the day of my first performance with the Reduced Shakespeare Company, which was at Pepperdine University in 1989, and our presenter was Tom Gabbard. Strangely, neither of us has aged.
That's amazing. You still have all the same amount of hair you always had.
Well, we have that advantage.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. Thanks for bringing us along. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 155, Big Shot Broadway Producer. Tom Gabbard is the president of the North Carolina Blumenthal Performing Arts Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, and an old friend of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Not only has he booked us all around the country, including our several recent gigs at the Blumenthal in Charlotte, not only does he sit down with Reed Martin and myself and agree to be interviewed about his work as both presenter and producer, but he pays for lunch. We love this man. Tom, you go back with the Reduced Shakespeare Company so long, back to its early days.
Well, I go back to, I think, when actually this was a 10-minute show at the Renaissance Pleasure Fair that Adam Long was one of our students at Pepperdine.
Wow.
And the Renaissance Fair in L.A. was not very far away, maybe 15 minutes away. And they started performing as a short show at the Pleasure Fair.
Wow. God, you've been... You've been with the Reduced Shakespeare Company longer than I have, then. That's what that means.
Yeah, I think that was probably back in about 1982, 83, something like that.
Yeah. And then you were the programming director at Pepperdine University, and from then you moved on to other venues where you've booked us as well.
Right. In Colorado at the Arvada Center, and then in Green Bay at the Widener Center, and now here in Charlotte.
That's right. But in addition to all that presenting, all the being a presenter of bringing in things, you're also a big shot Broadway producer. Is that accurate?
Well, we have our fingers in a lot of things on Broadway as well as the West End, national tours.
So it is. I mean, your two jobs are, it's win-win. I mean, one, you're... presenting work helps the producing work, I imagine.
It sure does. And you know, in our case, we have six stages here. I like to describe myself as somebody who has six hungry mouths to feed. And so making sure that our pipeline is filled with really, really good quality, everything from musicals to one-person shows, it's really important for us, you know, to be involved frequently at the front end to make sure that exciting new things are being created to come here.
Well, and can you talk about the differences a little bit between the two jobs, between presenting at a place like Blumenthal Center versus producing? Because I think I know how presenting works. You find shows, you pay some money, you bring them in and put them on and sell the tickets.
It's not
quite that easy.
Well, and I think, frankly, being a producer that has an experience as a presenter is really, really helpful because you have, perhaps, as a producer, you have a longer vision as to the life of a piece, that it's not just about Broadway, it's not just about a national tour, it's about what the life for a show is going to be, and not just how's a show going to play in New York, but how are audiences across America or even internationally, how are those audiences going to respond?
So when you come aboard backing up to what actually a producer is. I mean, you're not one guy. You're the head of a company, and the company is the producer. And what does that mean? To bring all the people together, raise money, all of the above?
Well, the group that I am most involved with is a group called the Independent Presenters Network. And so it represents performing arts centers that are nonprofit, as well as some for-profit groups like Nederlander. And these are all folks that present Broadway in their cities. Among our members, it represents actually 110 cities across North America where we produce Broadway shows. And so what I do is try to aggregate investment money from all those folks so that we can take a significant ownership stake in various shows and have then some say in decision-making. So we're not just, as venues, sitting back powerless to shape you know, what the plans are for that show, that we're actually part of the business decision making to make sure that shows do get out.
Right.
So you come aboard, your group and the other investors come aboard to produce a show. And they're not, as you said, they're not just interested in the New York run, but really in the life, the commercial life of the piece, whatever, in whatever media that transpires?
Right. You know, when you're involved with an original Broadway production, your financial interest goes on, of course, to a national tour, but then it goes on to future licensing, amateur licensing. It could go on to include film, television, you know, for instance, when Hairspray was done, the musical Hairspray was done as a film, those investors and those producers of the original Broadway production financially benefited from that.
Right.
So do you get involved with producing shows, commercial shows, that end up not coming to Charlotte?
Occasionally, but you know, our main interest in producing is really with an eye to things that we think would be good for the Charlotte market.
Okay.
And so if it doesn't come here, it's usually because the show hasn't worked. It hasn't been successful.
Okay.
But if it is successful, and, you know, there are sometimes shows that we know are going to be successful here that, frankly, don't succeed in New York. I mean, right now, I'm very much involved with the musical 9 to 5 that was not successful in New York, but we know on the road is going to be a huge, huge hit.
Right.
That was successful in Los Angeles, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, Los Angeles really embraced it, but that was a limited run. It was only about 7 weeks.
Right.
And but on the road, we know it's going to be hugely successful.
So what factors into a show's success in New York, say, versus the so-called regions?
Boy, New York is a very, very tough market. I mean, it's such an expensive place to produce that the original show typically will be three times as expensive as it is to be mounted to go out on the road.
And is that because of theater costs? This is what I understand it to be. Theater costs, advertising costs, backstage, well, union personnel across the board.
You know, it's a variety of factors, but I think the stagehand cost is a big, big part of it. I mean, it can take several million dollars just to load in the show.
Yeah, right.
And so, yeah, I'd say the stagehand costs are really the key thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that frequently the New York press will react differently to these shows than certainly audiences will across the U.S. And unfortunately, you know, a show in New York that collects a few negative reviews sometimes has difficulty overcoming those things.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked in other podcasts about the new viral marketing with podcasts and Twitter and Facebook and everything. Are you seeing that as advantageous? Is there any way that kind of viral marketing can help offset a bad review from the New York Times?
Yeah, it certainly makes a big difference because, you know, young and old, a recommendation from a friend carries a lot of weight.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was a producer of Legally Blonde, and we really energized among tweens a lot of text messaging that was really successful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no question, you know, that little show, which got mixed reviews from the critics, ended up really, really benefiting then from a reality show that we did on MTV.
Yeah.
And that show was not only a benefit to the show in New York, but now that the show is out on national tour, we know that a lot of folks come to see it on the road because they fell in love with the show through the MTV reality show.
Tell us the story about when we were here last time, you were telling me about the decision to put Legally Blonde on TV in its entirety? And how, there was a debate whether that was going to be a good thing for the commercial life of the show or a bad thing, and how that came about and what the results were.
Yeah, Legally Blonde was the very first Broadway show to allow itself to be out on television before it closed.
Okay.
There had been other Broadway shows that you could see on TV, particularly pay-per-view. There have been a few experiments, but never when the show was still playing on Broadway, because the idea was that once you made it available for free on TV, people would quit paying for it. So MTV approached us, and they were very enthusiastic about the show. It was with the understanding that they would have a limited number of times to broadcast it. They were guaranteeing to broadcast it, I think it was something like 3 times, but they had the option to go up to 6, but no more than 6. And ultimately, you know, even though some of our partners were nervous about that, you know, we felt that it would really, really help reach, especially that tween audience, and energize them to come. One of the analogies that made me feel very comfortable about it was, frankly, professional sports. That there was a point in time, believe it or not, that some people were really nervous about broadcasting baseball games. They thought it would, you know, end up undermining sales at the stadium.
Right.
But the reality is, seeing it on television, I think most people would agree, has enhanced their ability to ultimately sell tickets to those teams.
It's just constant advertising.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it's brand awareness, and especially with younger audiences, mm-hmm. I think, frankly, the repetition is really important. It sounds crazy, but there's a good deal of research to show that those tweens, especially with Legally Blonde, the fact that they watched it 3 or 4 times actually made it even more likely that they wanted to come see the show. That repetition ultimately was a catalyst to wanting to buy the big Broadway ticket.
Well, it must work because Coca-Cola doesn't spend all that money to get its name everywhere just because it's going to sell one more bottle. It's that top-of-mind awareness, as they say in the marketing biz.
Well, and we get so many people at our shows in the lobby, you know, last night. Yep. Oh, I've seen your video. We watched it in school. I saw it on PBS. Mm-hmm. And then they want to come see it in person. I remember as a kid, they wouldn't broadcast the Giants baseball home games, because they thought it would, you know, right, take away from attendance. And as you say, it's exactly the opposite.
Hootman, you're thinking with your dipstick, Jimmy, because you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, aren't you?
Where can you see the RSC? This week is Thanksgiving week here in the States, so you can see us on our YouTube channel. But next week, we start our 3-week run at the Overture Center in Madison, Wisconsin on December 3rd. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for more venue and ticket information. It's also the final week to vote for the Reduce Shakespeare Company podcast for the People's Choice Cultural Arts Podcast Award. If it's before November 30th, 2009, as you hear this, go to PodcastAwards.com and vote for the RSC podcast in the cultural arts category. Once again, thanks for taking the time to vote and for spreading the word. For the first time, the National Public Radio show This American Life is not nominated in the cultural arts category, so fingers crossed, we might actually have a chance to win. And now, back to our lunch with presenter and producer Tom Gabbard. What's it like producing commercial theater now in this economy? Is it better than ever? Is it? Do you have to raise money? Is it harder? Easier?
You know, for me, it's not harder raising money because the people I'm turning to are venues across the country who have an interest in these shows. But there's no question my colleagues in New York that raise money from individuals are finding it much tougher. You know, there were people that made huge profits in the stock market with hedge funds that were able to churn it back into the theater business, and so a lot of those folks that had been investors privately the last few years have gone away. There, it was an amazing number of theater investors that were touched by the Madoff embezzlement. So, some of my colleagues are finding it much, much more difficult.
And just rattle off a list of some of the professional commercial shows that you are involved with.
Right now, Spamalot, The Color Purple, 9 to 5, Ragtime, Thoroughly Modern Millie, Frost Nixon, over in London, Matthew Bourne's Edward Scissorhands, The Car Man, Off-Broadway, Basic Training. Those are just a few.
Cool. That's
and rattle off some names that you've worked with.
Oh, names. Yes, famous people.
Oh. Well, Mike Nichols, of course, was our director for Spamalot.
Uh-huh.
And Oprah Winfrey was our co-producer on The Color Purple.
Right.
And a huge, huge supporter of what we were doing. So some great people.
So can you tell us what happened on the morning after Spamalot when it was such a hit? You got fantastic reviews. What does a big shot Broadway producer do the next morning?
Well, every team of producers after a show opens assembles to look at the reviews that have come out. You know, a lot of people don't realize that the critics actually, in New York at least, they don't come opening night. They come the last two or three days before the show opens. And so by the time you get to opening night, the reviews are actually starting to appear as soon as the curtain goes up. So by the next morning, there are, you know, dozens and dozens of reviews to scour. And then, first of all, to decide, are we a hit? Are we not a hit? And most of all, what are the reviews that we can extract to use for advertising purposes? So in the case of Spamalot, you know, we were blessed to open with what then was the second highest advance in the history of Broadway. So we knew financially we were already a hit. And then, you know, fortunately the next morning we realized that the critics thought we were a hit as well and had these great reviews. So the producers at Serena Coin, our advertising agency, assembled to look at all these things. The morning after opening night. And in the meantime, between the cast party and our assembling, our director, Mike Nichols, and his wife, Diane Sawyer, they had already looked through these reviews. And out of respect to all the different members of the creative team, they had actually extracted the nicest things said about any member of the creative staff, performers, designers, everybody. And so they had actually laid out on a grid all the nice things so that when we planned a quote ad, we could be sure to give everyone acknowledgement and to give it in a balanced way. Conversely, our director, Eric Idle...
Your writer.
Our writer, Eric Idle. Eric, who's a very astute businessman, realized, you know, we had the second highest advance in the history of Broadway, and there really wasn't any reason to take any advertising. We were sold out for the next year, and he said, don't even take an ad. But then he also acknowledged we might still want to. He says, so if you're going to take an ad, though, I want it to be in Finnish. So what we ultimately did was try to appease both. And so we took three pages of advertising, the first page, of course, being in Finnish, and then turning the page for two full pages, glorying in all the great quotes and compliments that our creative team had. But, you know, let me go back to that repetition issue, because it's one reason why, you know, I've been enthusiastic about Reduce Shakespeare Company, is that I think that ability, you know, to see a company that develops a fan base that people are loyal to, that they look forward to seeing, and seeing changes over time, seeing different shows, you know, maybe sometimes there'll be a different cast member, that frankly, there's good that comes out of that repetition. And a lot of my presenter colleagues, frankly, I think, don't really understand that. They think that they should all be about bringing the hot, latest new thing and constantly introducing new shows.
Right.
And there's a place for that, but there's also a place for understanding that you should be nurturing a fan base for artists and shows.
And what I also love is that the repetition we discover night after night doesn't seem to work 100%, because we had two women last night who were absolutely convinced they had seen The Three of Us in London 6 years ago.
Yeah, and we'd been in London before that and trained the people that they had seen. But right. No, it was you guys. I assure you it wasn't, but I'm glad you had a good time.
Yeah, I know. They don't know. They don't know. Well, we saw the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Doesn't matter which bozos it was.
Well, I think it's fantastic that you guys have the tradition of being out in the lobby and greeting the public. You know, that just doesn't happen very often. But yet it is such a smart thing to do and so welcome among audiences.
Well, I saw Penn and Teller do it 20 years ago, and I thought, what a great idea. Even if I don't talk to them, I see them. how cool is that they're standing there shaking hands and whatever? I just thought it was a great... The show's not over. The relationship continues. You didn't come in, buy your ticket, see the thing. It's over. It goes on.
Well, and when we started it, we'd also seen the Flying Karamazov brothers do it.
Yeah.
And I was afraid, well, what if you go out the lobby and all the people who didn't like the show come up and tell you that? It's so rare.
Yeah.
Even when you have what seems like a batch or that maybe the audience didn't enjoy it, they inevitably enjoyed it and come up and say, oh, it was so great. And we enjoy it probably more than they do.
Yeah. Most nights.
Most nights.
Well, and I think ultimately it just kind of seals the deal when it comes to the good experience people have had. It's the kind of thing that takes the good experience and the memory of it and sears it in their memory. I mean, I as much as people have had a good time, I don't think they frequently would recall it as well as they do, but for that experience of seeing you guys afterwards.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your big shot Broadway credits via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can interact with other fans at both our website, reducedshakespeare.com, and our Reduced Shakespeare Company fan page at facebook.com. You can also find us at myspace.com/reducedshakespeare, become a subscriber to our YouTube channel, or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/reduced. There are links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, the designer of our brand new Reduced Shakespeare Company website at reducedshakespeare.com. Big shot office manager Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Becca Stretton. No reason. It's just random. Special thanks to Eddie McCracken, the star of those not annoying at all commercials for Castrol Motor Oil. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 155 465ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
That dialogue, that ongoing relationship with the fans is, I mean, that's one of the reasons we do the podcast. But I guess you could think of us as the hottest old thing.
Hottest middle-aged thing.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.